Li Dun. Pino had no idea what Lyris was talking about, but he followed him past the black shirts to an archway. Stone steps climbed toward a villa with blooming garden beds on either side. They reached a colonnade along the front of the villa and walked down it toward a stone terrace. General Lyris walked around the corner onto the terrace, came up short, cracked his heels together, and took off his hat, before dropping his head in studied deference.
Duce.
3. Pino walked up behind the Nazi, wide-eyed in disbelief. Not 5 meters from him stood Benito Mussolini. The Italian dictator wore tan riding breeches, high-glossed boots that hit him below the knee, and a white tunic opened well down his chest, revealing gray hair and the beginnings of an old man's belly that strained against the lower buttons of the shirt. Il Duce's great bald head and the skin above his famous jawline were flushed. He held a glass of red wine. There was a half-empty carafe of wine on the table behind the dictator.
"General Lyris,"
Mussolini said, nodding, and then turning his rheumy eyes on Pino.
"Who the hell are you?"
Pino stammered. "Today I am the general's interpreter, Duce."
"Ask him how he is,"
Lyris said to Pino in French.
"Ask him if I can be of help today."
Pino did so in Italian. Mussolini threw his head back and roared with laughter, then sneered.
"How is Il Duce?"
A brunette with formidable breasts bulging against a sleeveless white blouse came out onto the terrace. She wore sunglasses and also carried a glass of wine. A cigarette smoldered between her ruby lips. Mussolini said,
"Tell them, Clara, how is Mussolini?"
She took a drag, blew smoke, then said, "Benito is feeling pretty shitty these days." Pino tried not to gape. He knew who she was. Everyone in Italy knew who she was. Claretta Petacci was the dictator's notorious mistress. Her picture was always in the papers. He couldn't believe she was right there in front of him. Mussolini stopped laughing, turned dead serious, looked at Pino, and said,
"Tell the general that. Tell him Il Duce is feeling pretty shitty these days. And ask him if he can fix the things that make Il Duce feel shitty."
Pino translated. Irritated, Lyris said,
"Tell him maybe we can help each other. Tell him if he sees about ending the strikes in Milan and Turin, I'll do what I can for him."
Pino gave it to Mussolini word for word. The dictator snorted.
"I can end the strikes if you pay my workers in hard currency and make them safer."
"I'll pay them in Swiss francs, but I can't control the bombers,"
Lyris said.
"We have moved many factory operations underground, but there are not enough tunnels to make them all safe. In any case, as far as Italy is concerned, we are at a turning point in the war. The latest intelligence indicates as many as 7 Allied divisions were moved out of Italy to France following the invasion there, which means my Gothic line will hold through the winter if I can keep it supplied. But I cannot be assured of that happening if I do not have competent machinists to turn out weapons and parts. So can you end the strikes for me, Duce? I'm sure the Führer will be pleased at your support."
"Done with a phone call," Mussolini said, snapped his fingers, and poured more wine.
"Excellent," General Lyris said.
"What else can I help you with?"
"How about control of my country?"
the dictator said bitterly, picking up his glass and draining it. After Pino translated, the general took a long breath and said,
"You have much control, Duce. It's why I came to you to stop the strikes.
Il Duce has much control,
Mussolini said, thick with sarcasm and glancing at his mistress, who nodded encouragement.
Then why are my soldiers in Germany digging ditches or dying on the Eastern Front? Why no meetings with Kesselring? Why are decisions being made about Italy without its president at the table? Why won't Hitler pick up the goddamned phone?
The dictator shouted the last question. Liars seemed unruffled, as Pinault translated. Liars said,
I can't presume to know why the Führer hasn't taken your calls, Duce, but fighting wars on three fronts is a busy business.
I know why Hitler won't take my goddamn calls!
Mussolini bellowed and slammed his glass on the table. He glared at the general and then Pinault, in a way that made Pinault wonder if he should retreat a step or two.
Who is the most hated man in all of Italy?
Mussolini said, directing the question at Pinault. Flustered, Pinault didn't know what to say, but then started to translate. Mussolini cut him off, still talking to Pinault, slapping his chest and saying,
Il Duce is the most hated man in Italy, just like Hitler is the most hated man in Germany. But you see, Hitler, he does not care. Il Duce cares about his people's love. But Hitler doesn't give a dog's turd for love. All he cares about is fear.
Pinault was doing his best to keep up when the dictator seemed to come to some kind of revelation.
Clara, do you know why the most hated man in Italy is not in control of his own country?
His mistress stubbed out a cigarette, blew smoke, then said,
Adolf Hitler?
That's right, Il Duce cried. It's because the most hated man in Germany hates the most hated man in Italy. It's because Hitler treats his Nazi shepherd dogs better than he treats the president of Italy. Keeps me locked up in the middle of...
I don't have time for this madness, General Liers snapped at Pinault. Tell him I will see about a meeting with Field Marshal Kesselring in the next few days, and to expect a call from the Führer within the week. It's the best I can do for now.
Pinault translated, expecting another explosion from Mussolini. Instead, these concessions seemed to please the dictator, who began to button his tunic, saying,
How soon with Kesselring?
I am on my way to meet with him now, Duce, Liers said. I'll have his aide call before nightfall. Herr Hitler's attention may take a little longer to attract.
Mussolini nodded in a statesmanlike manner, as if he'd gained back some of his illusory power, and now planned to use it on the cosmos.
Very good, General Liers,
Mussolini said, checking his cuffs.
I shall have the strikes ended before nightfall.
Liers clicked his heels, dropped his head, and said,
I'm sure the Field Marshal and the Führer will be pleased. Thank you again for your time and influence, Duce.
The general pivoted and strode away. Pinault hesitated, not quite sure what to do, and then bowed quickly to Mussolini and to Claretta Petacci before bolting after Liers, who had disappeared around the corner and onto the colonnade. He caught up to him and walked at the general's right shoulder until they'd almost reached the staff car, when he hurried ahead and opened the rear door. General Liers hesitated, studied Pinault for several long seconds, before saying,
Well done, Vorarbeiter.
Thank you, mon général,
Pinault sputtered.
Now get me out of this insane asylum, Liers said and climbed inside. Take me to the telephone exchange in Milan. Do you know it?
Yes, of course, mon général, Pinault said.
Liers unlocked the valise and engrossed himself in his work. Pinault drove in silence, glancing at the rearview mirror and arguing with himself. When the general had complimented him, he'd swelled with pride. But now he was wondering why. Liars was a Nazi, a slave driver, a master builder of war. How could Pino feel pride when the compliment had come from someone like that? He couldn't. He shouldn't. And yet he had. And it bothered him. By the time they reached the outskirts of Milan, however, Pino had decided to feel proud of how much he'd learned driving General Liars for little more than half a day. His uncle wouldn't believe it. He'd actually talked to Mussolini and Claretta Petacci. How many spies in Italy could say that? Pino took the route Hannibal had followed with his war elephants and got them to Piazzale Loreto in record time. He took the roundabout, seeing Mr. Beltramini at his post out in front of the fruit and vegetable stand, where he was helping an older woman. Pino wanted to wave as he went by, but when he tried to take a right, a German lorry cut him off. They almost crashed. He was able to swerve the staff car out of the way in the nick of time. He couldn't believe the driver had done that. Hadn't they seen the flags? He'd forgotten to put up the general's flags upon entering Milan. He'd have to make another loop around the rotary. As he did, he saw Carletto walking on the sidewalk toward one of his favorite cafes. Pino sped up, made the turn onto Viale Abruzzi without incident, and was soon parked at the telephone exchange, which was heavily guarded. The heavy Nazi presence puzzled him at first, until he thought that he who controlled the telephone exchange controlled communication.
"I have 3 hours of work to do here," General Liars said. "You do not have to wait. No one would dare touch the car here. Be back at 1700 hours.
"Oui, mon général," Pino said, and opened the rear door.
4. He waited until Liars was inside, and then headed back toward Piazzale Loreto and Beltramini's fresh fruits and vegetables. In less than a block, he'd endured enough vile looks to realize he'd be smart to take off the swastika armband and stick it in his back pocket. That made things better. People barely gave him a glance. He was in uniform, and he wasn't SS or Wehrmacht. That was all they would care about. He broke into a trot. He could see Mr. Beltramini right there up ahead, putting grapes in a sack. But he really wanted to see Carletto. It had been 4 months, and he had so much to tell his old friend. Pino cut across the street in front of German lorries traveling in a convoy and took a right. Scanning the sidewalk ahead, he found Carletto sitting with his back to him. Pino broke into a grin, walked up, and saw Carletto was reading. He pulled back a chair and sat down, saying, "Hope you're not waiting for an elegant young lady." Carletto looked up. At first, his friend looked wearier and more scarred than Pino remembered, even in late April. But then Carletto recognized him and cried out,
"Oh my God, Pino! I thought you were dead!"
He jumped up and hugged Pino fiercely. Then he pushed Pino back to look at him with misty eyes.
"I really did."
"Who said I was dead?"
"Someone told Papa you were guarding the Modena train station when a bomb hit. They said part of your head was taken off. I was devastated."
"No, no," Pino said. "That was the guy with me. I almost lost these." He showed him the bandaged hand and wiggled the reattached fingers. Carletto clapped him on the shoulder and grinned.
"Just knowing you are alive," he said, "I think I'm happier than I've ever been."
"Good to be back from the dead," Pino smiled. "You ordered?"
"Just espresso," Carletto said, taking his seat again.
"Let's eat," Pino said.
"I got paid before I left the hospital, so it's on me."
That made his old friend even happier, and they ordered melon balls wrapped in prosciutto, salami, bread, garlic-infused olive oil, and a cold tomato soup that was perfect in the stifling heat. As they waited for their meal to arrive, Pino caught up on the last 4 months of Carletto's life.
Because of Mr. Beltramini's contacts outside the city, his fruit and vegetable stand continued to prosper. It was one of the few places in the city that had a reliable flow of produce, and it often sold out before closing. Carletto's mother was another story.
"Some days are better than others, but she's weak all the time," Carletto said. Pino could see the strain on him.
"She got real sick last month. Pneumonia. Papa was heartbroken, thinking she was going, but somehow she rallied and beat it."
"That's good," Pino said, as the waiter started setting plates on the table.
His eyes drifted past Carletto, back toward the fruit stand. Between gaps in the German lorry convoy, he caught glimpses of Mr. Beltramini serving a customer.
"So is that the new fascist uniform, Pino?" Carletto asked. "I don't think I've seen it before."
Pino started chewing the inside of his cheek. He'd been so ashamed of enlisting in the German army, he'd never told his friend about the organization Tot. Carletto went on.
"And why were you in Modena? Everyone I know is headed north."
"It's complicated," Pino said, wanting to change the subject.
"What's that mean?"
his friend asked, eating one of the melon balls.
"Can you keep a secret?" Pino said.
"What are best friends for?"
"Right," Pino said, then leaned forward and whispered.
"This morning, Carletto, not 2 hours ago, I talked to Mussolini and Claretta Petacci."
Carletto sat back skeptically.
"You're making that up."
"No, I am not, I swear." A car honked on the rotary. A bicyclist carrying a messenger bag shot by them. So close to their table, Pino swore he was going to hit Carletto, who jerked to one side to avoid him.
"Idiot," Carletto said, twisting around in his chair. "He's riding on the sidewalk against traffic. He's going to hurt someone."
Seeing the bicyclist from the rear now, Pino noticed a patch of red sticking up from beneath his dark shirt, right at the neckline. He wove through and around pedestrians crowding the sidewalk as three more lorries in the long German convoy began to make the slow turn onto congested Viale Abruzzi. The bicyclist tugged the messenger bag off his shoulder. With his left hand on the handlebar and his right holding the bag strap, he curved the bike onto Viale Abruzzi and came right up behind one of the lorries. Pino realized what was about to happen, jumped up, and yelled,
"No!"
The bicyclist lobbed the bag up through the canvas cover and into the back of the lorry before streaking away. Mr. Beltramini had seen the toss, too. He was standing right there, not 6 meters away, his hands starting to rise a split second before the vehicle exploded in a pluming ball of fire. The force of the blast punched Pino and Carletto from a block away. Pino dove to the ground, protecting his head from debris and shrapnel.
"Papa!"
Carletto screamed. Cut up and ignoring the blast material raining down on Piazzale Loreto, Carletto sprinted toward the fire, toward the incinerated skeleton of the troop transport, and toward his father, sprawled across the sidewalk beneath the tatters of the fruit stand's awning. Carletto got to his father before Wehrmacht soldiers from other lorries fanned out to control the area. Two of them blocked Pino's way until he pulled out the red armband and put it on, showing them the swastika.
"I am General Lyers's aide," he said in halting German. "I must get through."
They let him pass. Pino ran from the heat of the still-burning lorry, aware of people screaming and moaning, but caring only about Carletto, who knelt on the sidewalk with his father's scorched and bloody head in his lap. Mr. Beltramini's smock was blackened from the blast and lathered with more blood, but he was alive. His eyes were open, and he was breathing with great difficulty. Choking back tears, Carletto looked up, saw Pino and said, "Get an ambulance!"
Pino heard sirens wailing in all directions, closing on Piazzale Loreto.
"They're coming," he said, and squatted down.
Mr. Beltramini was taking big, ragged breaths and twitching.
"Don't move, Papa," Carletto said.
"Your mother,"
Mr. Beltramini said, his eyes lazing.
"You've got to care for..."
"Quiet, Papa,"
his son said, weeping and stroking his father's singed hair. Mr. Beltramini coughed and hacked, and had to have been in such hideous pain that Pino tried to distract him with some pleasant memory.
"Mr. Beltramini, do you remember that night on the hill when my father played violin and you sang to your wife?" Pino asked.
"Nessun dorma," he said in a whisper, went far away in his thoughts, and smiled.
"You sang con smania and never sounded better," Pino said.
For a moment or two, the three of them were a universe unto themselves, outside all the pain and horror, back on a rural hillside, sharing a more innocent time. Then Pino heard the clanging of the ambulances much closer. He thought to get up and find a medic. But when he tried to stand, Mr. Beltramini clutched at his sleeve. Carletto's father was staring in bewilderment at the lurid armband Pino wore.
"A Nazi?" he choked. "No, Mr. Beltramini."
"Traitor?"
the fruitmonger said, overwhelmed.
"Pino?"
"No, Mr.—"
Mr. Beltramini coughed again and hacked, and this time brought up dark blood that spilled over his chin as he lolled his head back toward Carletto, gazing at his son and wordlessly moving his lips. And then he just eased away, as if his spirit had accepted death, yet lingered, not struggling, but in no hurry to be gone. Carletto broke down sobbing. Pino did too. His friend rocked his father and began to keen with grief. The agony of his loss built and swelled with every breath, until it seemed to contort every muscle and bone in Carletto's body.
"I'm sorry," Pino cried.
"Oh, Carletto, I'm so damned sorry. I loved him too."
Carletto stopped rocking his father, looked up at Pino, blind with hatred.
"Don't say that," he shouted. "Don't ever say that! You Nazi! You traitor!"
Pino's jaw felt like it had been broken in 20 places.
"No," he said. "It's not what it looks. Get away from me!"
Carletto screamed.
"My father saw it. He knew what you are. He showed it to me."
"Carletto, it's just an armband."
"Leave me alone! I never want to see you again, ever!"
Carletto dropped his chin and broke down over his father's dead body, his shoulders trembling and tortured sounds hacking up from his chest. Pino was so overwhelmed that he couldn't say a thing. He stood up and finally stepped back.
"Move on," a German officer said. "Clear the sidewalk for the ambulances."
Pino took one last look at the Beltraminis before walking south toward the telephone exchange, feeling like the blast had cut out part of his heart. 5. That sense of loss still tortured Pino 7 hours later when he parked the Daimler in front of Dolly Stottlemyre's apartment building. General Lyers got out, handed Pino his briefcase, and said,
"You've had quite the first day."
"Oui, mon général."
"You're sure you saw a red scarf around the bomber's neck?"
"He had it tucked beneath his shirt, but yes."
The general hardened and entered the building, with Pino lugging the valise, which had only gotten heavier since morning. The old crone was right where they'd left her,
sitting on her stool and blinking at them from behind those thick glasses. Liars never gave her a glance, just charged up the stairs to Dolly's apartment and knocked. Anna opened the door, and at the sight of her, Pino's heart mended a little.
"Dolly's held dinner for you, General," Anna said as he moved past her.
Despite everything that had happened to Pino that day, seeing Anna again was as dazzling an experience as it had been the first two times. The pain of seeing Mr. Beltramini die and losing his friend endured. But he had faith that if he could tell Anna about it all, somehow she'd make it make sense.
"Are you coming in for a bite?"
Anna asked impatiently.
"Or are you just going to stand there staring at me?"
Pino startled, moved past her, and said, "I wasn't staring."
"Of course you were."
"No, I was somewhere else. In my mind." She said nothing and closed the door. Dolly came into view at the other end of the hall. The general's mistress wore black stiletto heels, black silk hosiery, and a tight black skirt below a pearl-colored short-sleeve blouse. Her hair looked freshly coiffed.
"The general says you saw the bombing?"
Dolly said, lighting a cigarette. He nodded and put the valise on the bench, feeling Anna's attention on him too.
"How many dead?"
Dolly asked, and took a puff. "Many Germans and several Milanese," he said.
"Must have been horrid,"
Dolly said. General Liars appeared again. His tie was gone. He said something in German to Dolly, who nodded and looked to Anna.
"The general would like to eat."
"Of course, Dolly,"
Anna said, glanced at Pino again, hurried down the hallway, and disappeared. Liars walked toward Pino, studying him, before picking up the valise.
"Return at 0700 sharp."
"Oui, mon général,"
he said, and stood there.
"You are dismissed, Vorarbeiter."
Pino wanted to linger, to see if Anna might reappear, but instead he saluted and left. He drove the Daimler back to the motor pool, trying to replay his day. But his mind kept lurching between images of Mr. Beltramini dying, Carletto's grief-driven rage, and the look Anna had given him before leaving the front hall. Then he remembered his encounter with Mussolini and his mistress, and as he gave the night sentry the keys to the Daimler and walked on through the streets of San Babila toward home, he wondered if he'd hallucinated them. The August night air was thick and warm. The smells of fine cuisine dueled in the air, and many Nazi officers sat at outdoor cafes, drinking and carousing. Pino reached Albanese luggage and went around back to the sewing room entrance. When his uncle answered his knock, he felt waves of emotion.
"Well," Uncle Albert said after he'd come inside, "how did it go?"
Raw grief burst out of Pino.
"I don't even know where to start," he cried.
"What in God's name happened?"
"Can I eat something? I haven't had a thing since morning."
"Of course, of course. Greta has saffron risotto waiting for you, and once you've eaten, you can tell us everything right from the beginning."
Pino wiped at his tears. He hated that he'd cried in front of his uncle. But the emotions had just come over him, or out of him, like a pipe bursting. Wordlessly, he ate two helpings of his aunt's risotto, and then described everything that had happened to him during the course of his day with General Liars. They were shocked by his description of the slaves in the rail tunnel, though Uncle Albert said they'd been getting reports of the Germans taking factories and ammo dumps underground.
"You really went to Mussolini's house?"
Aunt Greta said.
"To his villa," Pino said.
"He and Claretta Petacci were there.
No.
Yes, Pino insisted, and repeated what he'd heard about the factory strikes being resolved in return for Mussolini's getting a seat at Kesselring's table, and the promise of a phone call from Adolf Hitler. Then he recounted the worst of it. How Mr. Beltramini died thinking Pino was a traitor, and how his best friend never wanted to see him again because he was a Nazi, a disgrace.
Not true, Uncle Albert said, looking up from the pad where he'd taken notes. You're a quiet hero for getting this information. I'll get it to Baca, and he'll transmit what you've seen to the Allies.
But I can't tell Carletto, Pino said. And his father...
I hate to be blunt about it, Pino, but I don't care. Your position is too valuable and sensitive to risk telling anyone. You're just going to have to swallow all that for now and have faith that your friendship will come back when you're able to reveal all. I'm serious, Pino. You're a spy behind enemy lines. Take every insult someone may hurl at you, ignore it, and stay as close to liars as you can for as long as you can.
Pino nodded, but without enthusiasm. So you think what I found out helps? Uncle Albert snorted.
We now know of a large ammo dump inside a tunnel near Como. We know the Nazis are using slaves. And we know Mussolini is a eunuch, powerless and frustrated because Hitler won't take his calls. What more could I expect on day one?
Pino felt good about that and yawned. I need to sleep. He expects me early. He hugged them both, went downstairs and through the small factory. The alley door opened. Baca, the radio operator, came in, looked at Pino, and studied his uniform. It's complicated, Pino said, and left. His father had gone to bed by the time Pino walked home and went through a quick security check in the lobby. He set his alarm, stripped, and collapsed on his bed. Terrible images, thoughts, and emotions created a whirlwind in his mind that had him sure he'd never sleep again. But when he was finally able to limit his spiraling memories to Anna, he felt soothed, and with the maid firmly in his mind, he slipped off into darkness.
Chapter 17. August 9th, 1944. 6:45 a.m. 1. Pino jumped from the Daimler he'd parked on Via Dante. He went into Dolly's building, hurried past the blinking old crone and up the stairs, eager to knock on the general's mistress's door. He was disappointed when Dolly answered. General Lyers was already in the hallway, drinking coffee from a china cup and looking eager to leave. Pino went and got the valise, still not seeing the maid, and turned back toward Dolly and the apartment door, feeling even more disappointed. Dolly called out,
Anna, the general needs his food.
A moment later, and to Pino's nervous delight, the maid appeared with the thermos and a brown paper bag. The general headed toward the apartment door. Pino went to Anna and said, I'll take them. Anna actually smiled at him as she handed him the thermos, which he slid under one arm before accepting the lunch bag.
Have a nice day, she said, and be safe.
He grinned and said, I'll do my best.
Vorarbeiter, General Lyers barked.
Pino startled, spun around, and grabbed the valise. He hurried after Lyers, past Dolly, who held the apartment door open, and gave him a knowing look as he left. Lyers had a 4-hour meeting with Field Marshal Kesselring at the German house that morning. Pino was not invited to the table. The general appeared irritated and upset when he emerged after noon and told Pino to drive him to the telephone exchange. Pino sat in the Daimler, or lounge near it, mad with boredom. He wanted to go somewhere to eat, but did not want to leave the car. He was mere blocks from Piazzale Loreto, and debated whether he should go find Carletto, tell him enough that he didn't think him a traitor anymore. It would make Pino feel better, but should... He heard a voice calling over a loudspeaker and coming closer. An SS vehicle with 5 speakers on top came rolling down Viale Abruzzi.
"A warning to all citizens of Milan,"
a man brayed in Italian.
"The cowardly bombing of German soldiers yesterday will not stand. Turn the bomber in today or face punishment tomorrow. Repeat, a warning to all citizens of Milan."
Pino was so hungry he felt hollow and jittery as he watched the vehicle go by and heard the echoes of the loudspeakers as it went up and down the streets that fanned off Piazzale Loreto. German soldiers came past him mid-afternoon, nailing printed copies of the same warning about a bomber on telephone poles and gluing others to the sides of buildings. 3 hours later, General Liers stormed from the telephone exchange and looked furious when he climbed into the back seat of the Daimler. Pino had not eaten since 6 that morning, and he felt lightheaded and nervous getting into the driver's seat.
"Verdammte Idioten," Liers said in a cutting voice. "Verdammte Idioten."
Pino had no idea what it meant, and glanced in the rear view in time to see General Liers pound the seat with his fist 3 times. It left him red-faced and sweaty, and Pino looked away, for fear the general would turn his anger on him. In the back seat, Liers was taking deep breaths. When Pino at last looked again in the mirror, he saw the general, eyes closed, hands across his chest, his breathing slow and even. Was he sleeping? Pino didn't know what to do, other than to wait and swallow at the hunger that had him shaking. 10 minutes later, General Liers said,
"The Chancellery. Do you know it?"
Pino looked in the rear view, saw Liers' unreadable face, and returned,
"Oui, mon général."
He wanted to ask when he might stop to get something to eat, but held his tongue.
"Take down my flags. This is not an official visit."
2. Pino did as he was asked, started the car, and put it in gear, wondering what the general wanted at the Chancellery. He kept glancing at Liers as he wove through the city to Via Patari, but the general seemed lost in thought and revealed nothing. By the time they reached the Chancellery gate, the sun had set. There were no guards, and Liers told him to pull through to park. Pino drove on into a cobblestoned courtyard, surrounded by 2-story colonnades. He shut off the Daimler and climbed out. A fountain bubbled at the center of the courtyard. Dusk fell in a listless heat. Pino opened the door for General Liers, who stepped out.
"I may need you."
Pino wondered whom they were talking to tonight. Then it seemed obvious, and his heart began to pound. They were going to talk with Schuster. The Cardinal of Milan had a legendary memory. He would recall Pino as surely as Colonel Ralph had. But unlike the Gestapo chief, the Cardinal would remember his name. Cardinal Schuster would also see the swastika and judge him severely, probably damn him to some eternal misery. General Liers took a left at the top of the stairs, went to a heavy wooden door, and knocked. It was opened by an older priest, who seemed to recognize Liers with distaste, but stood aside to let him in. The priest gave Pino the evil eye as he passed. They went down a paneled hallway to an ornate and impressive sitting room with Catholic iconography sewn into 15th-century tapestries, carved into 13th-century crucifixes, and cast at every turn in gold and gilt. The only thing not Italianate in the room was the desk,
where a short, bald man in a simple cream-colored cassock and red skull cap was writing with his back to Pino and Liars. Cardinal Schuster seemed unaware of them, until the priest knocked on the door frame. Schuster stopped writing for a moment, but then wrote on another 4 or 5 seconds, finishing his thought before he looked up and turned. Liars removed his hat. Pino reluctantly did the same. The general walked toward Schuster, but spoke to Pino over his shoulder.
"Tell the cardinal that I appreciate his willingness to see me on such short notice, but it is important."
Pino tried to stay behind the general's shoulder, where it would be more difficult for the cardinal to see him clearly, and translated Lyris's words into Italian. Schuster leaned over, trying to see Pino.
"Ask the general how I can help him."
Pino looked at the rug and translated into French, which caused the cardinal to interrupt.
"I can summon a priest who speaks German if he wishes to make communication easier,"
Pino told Liars. The general shook his head.
"I don't want to take up his time or mine unnecessarily."
Pino told Schuster that Liars was happy with the interpreting as it stood. The cardinal shrugged, and Liars said,
"Your Eminence, I'm sure you have heard that 15 German soldiers were killed in a partisan bombing in Piazzale Loreto yesterday. And I'm sure you know that Colonel Ralph and the Gestapo want the bomber turned in before dawn, or the city faces harsh repercussions."
"I do," Cardinal Schuster said.
"How harsh?" "Any act of violence upon German soldiers by partisans will be countered by an appropriate act of violence on local males," the general said. "The decision was not mine, I assure you. General Wolf has that dishonor."
Pino was shocked as he translated, and saw that the potential repercussions had the same impact on Schuster's face. The cardinal said,
"If the Nazis follow that path, you will turn the population against you, harden the resistance. They'll show you no mercy in the end."
"I agree, Your Eminence, and have said so," General Liars said. "But my voice isn't being heard here or in Berlin."
The cardinal asked,
"What do you want me to do?"
"I don't know that there's much you can do, Your Eminence, other than to ask the bomber to surrender before punishment is imposed."
Schuster was lost in thought for a moment before saying,
"When will that happen?"
"Tomorrow."
"Thank you for informing me personally, General Liars," the cardinal said.
"Your Eminence," Liars said, bowed his head, clicked his heels, and pivoted toward the door, exposing Pino to Schuster.
The cardinal gazed at Pino with an inkling of recognition.
"My Lord Cardinal," Pino said in Italian, "please do not tell General Liars you know me. I am not what you think I am. I beg you, have mercy on my soul."
3. The cleric looked puzzled, but nodded. Pino bowed and walked away, following Liars back out into the Chancellery's courtyard, and thinking about what he'd just heard inside. Repercussions in the morning? That wasn't good. What would the Germans do? Appropriate acts of violence on adult males? That was what he'd said, wasn't it? When they reached the car, Liars said,
"What were you and the Cardinal saying at the end?"
Pino said,
"I was wishing him a good evening, mon général."
Liars studied him a moment before saying,
"Dollies, then. I've done all I can."
Although Pino was upset about the pending repercussions, he thought of Anna and drove as fast as he dared through the winding streets around the cathedral until he reached Dolly Stottlemyre's apartment building. He parked, opened the rear door, and tried to take the valise.
"I'll bring it up," the general said. "Stay with the car. We may go out again later."
That blew the wind out of Pino's lungs. If Liars caught his disappointment, he didn't show it as he disappeared through the front door. Only then did Pino's hunger pangs return with a vengeance. What was he supposed to do? Never eat? Never drink? Miserable, Pino looked up at the face of the building, saw slivers of light showing through the blackout curtains across Dolly's windows. Was Anna disappointed? Well, she had definitely smiled at him that morning. And it had been more than your ordinary run-of-the-mill smile, too, hadn't it? In Pino's mind, Anna's smile had spoken of attraction, possibility, and hope. She'd told him to be safe and used his name, hadn't she? In any case, Pino wasn't going to get to see her. Not tonight. Tonight he had to sleep in a car and starve. His heart felt heavy, and then heavier still when thunder drummed. He got the Daimler's canvas top up and snapped down before the rain came in torrents. He slumped in the driver's seat, deafened by the storm and feeling sorry for himself. Was he supposed to sleep out here all night? No food, no water? A half hour passed, and then an hour. The rain had slowed, but it still pattered off the roof. Pino's stomach was aching, and he thought of driving to his uncle's to report and get some food. But what if Liars came down and he was gone? What if... The front passenger side door opened. Holding a basket of delicious-smelling food, Anna climbed inside.
"Dolly thought you might be hungry," she said, closing the door. "I was sent to feed you and keep you company while you ate."
Pino smiled. "General's orders?"
"Dolly's orders," Anna said, peering around. "It will be easier to eat in the back seat, I think."
"That's the general's territory."
"He's busy in Dolly's bedroom," she said, climbed out, opened the back door, and got in. "He should be in there for a long while, if not the night."
Pino laughed, threw open the door, ducked through the rain, and climbed into the back. Anna set the basket where the general usually put his valise. She lit a small candle and set it on a plate. The light flickered, making the staff car's interior golden as she drew back a towel over the basket to reveal two roasted chicken legs with thighs, fresh bread, real butter, and a glass of red wine.
"I have been delivered," Pino said, which made Anna laugh.
On another night, he might have gazed at her as she laughed, but he was so hungry he just chuckled and ate. As he did, he asked her questions, learning that Anna was from Trieste. She had worked for Dolly for 14 months, and she had gotten the job through a friend who saw Dolly's ad in the newspaper.
"You don't know how much I needed that," he said, finishing the meal. "I was ravenous, like a wolf."
Anna laughed.
"I thought I heard someone howling outside."
"Is that your whole name?" he asked.
"Anna?" "I also go by Anna Marta."
"No last name?"
"Not anymore," the maid said, cooling and repacking the basket. "And I must be going."
"Wait," Pino said.
"Can't you stay just a little longer? I don't think I've ever met anyone as lovely and elegant as you."
She made a dismissive flip of her hand, but smiled.
"Listen to you."
"It's true."
"How old are you now, Pino?"
"Old enough to wear a uniform and carry a gun," he said, annoyed. "Old enough to do things that I can't talk about."
"Like what?"
she said, sounding interested. "I can't talk about it," Pino insisted.
Anna blew out the candle, leaving them in darkness.
Then I must go.
Before Pino could protest, she climbed out of the Daimler and shut the door behind her. Pino struggled out of the back seat in time to see her shadow going up the steps to the front door of the apartment building.
Buonanotte, signorina Anna Marta, Pino said.
Good night, Vorarbeiter Lella,
Anna said, and went inside. The rain had stopped, and he stood there a long while, looking at that spot where she disappeared, and reliving every moment of his time in the back seat of the staff car, with her smell all around. He noticed it after the food was gone, when she'd laughed that he'd been hungry as a wolf.
Had there ever been anything that smelled like that? Had there ever been a woman who looked like that? So beautiful. So mysterious.
At last he climbed back into the driver's seat and pulled his cap down over his eyes. His thoughts still on her, he questioned everything he'd said to her and dissected her every word as if they were clues to the puzzle of Anna. The horror of Mr. Beltramini's death, being branded a traitor. All these things had vanished from his consciousness. All he knew until sleep took him was the maid. 4. A sharp rap came at the window, waking Pino. It was barely cracking light. The back door opened. His first happy thought was that Anna had come down to feed him again. But when he looked over his shoulder, he saw the silhouette of General Lyers.
Fly my flags, Lyers said. Get me to San Vittore prison. We don't have much time.
Going for the glove compartment and the flags, Pino fought off a yawn and said,
What time is it, mon général?
5 a.m., he barked. So move!
Pino bolted from the staff car, mounted the flags, and then drove fast through the city, relying on the flags to get them quickly through checkpoints until they arrived at notorious San Vittore. Built in the 1870s, the prison had 6 three-story wings connected to a central hub. When San Vittore opened, it was state-of-the-art, but 74 years of neglect on, it was a nasty starfish of cells and halls where men fought for their lives every moment of every day. Now that it was under Gestapo rule, Pino couldn't name a place he feared more besides the Hotel Regina. On Via Vico, which paralleled the prison's high eastern wall, they confronted 2 lorries stopped by an open gate. The first lorry was backing up through the gate. The other idled on the street, blocking the way. Dawn glowed over the city when General Lyers got out and slammed the door. Pino jumped out and followed Lyers as he crossed the street and went through the gate with the guards saluting. They went into a large triangular yard that narrowed where the walls of 2 opposing arms of the prison joined the central hub. 4 steps beyond the gate, Pino stopped to take it all in. 8 armed Waffen SS soldiers stood about 25 meters to his left at 10 o'clock. In front of them was an SS captain. Beside the captain, Gestapo Colonel Walter Rauf held a black riding crop behind his back and watched with great interest. Lyers went to Rauf and the captain. Pino hung back, not wanting Rauf to notice him. The flaps at the back of the lorry opened. A squad from the multi-legion of the Black Brigades climbed out, fanatically dedicated to Mussolini. The elite fascist commandos wore black turtlenecks despite the warm air and jawless death head symbols on their hats and chests.
Are you ready? The SS captain said in Italian. A black shirt brushed past Pino as he called out, Bring them out.
The guards split into 2 groups of 4 and moved to open doors set in the walls of the prison wings. Prisoners began to shuffle out. Pino moved, trying to see the men better.
Some of them looked like they couldn't handle another step. Those that looked fitter had beards and such long hair that he didn't know if he'd recognize anyone he knew. Then, from the left-hand door, a tall, imposing young man appeared in the yard. Pino recognized him as Barbareschi, the seminarian, aide to Cardinal Schuster and forger for the resistance. Barbareschi must have been caught and arrested again, though other men shuffled into a loose formation, staring fearfully at the black shirt commandos. Barbareschi went defiantly to the front row.
"How many?" Colonel Ralph said.
148, one of the guards yelled back.
Two more, Ralph said.
The last man out the right-hand door tossed his head to get the hair from his eyes.
Tullio,
Pino gasped softly. Tullio Galimberti didn't hear him. Over the sounds of the last men moving into place, no one did. Tullio trudged out of sight behind the lorry. The black shirt commander stepped forward. General Lyers confronted Colonel Ralph and the SS captain. Pino could see and hear them arguing. Ralph finally gestured with the riding crop at the black shirt and said something that shut Lyers down. The fascist commander pointed to his far left and shouted,
"You there! Start counting off in tens! Every tenth man step forward!"
After a moment's pause, the man farthest left said,
"One."
"Two,"
said the second. It went on down the line until one of the weaker-looking men said,
"10,"
and stepped uncertainly forward.
"One,"
said the 11th man.
"Two,"
said the 12th. A moment later, Barbareschi said,
"8.
The second 10th man stepped forward, and soon the third. They were joined by 12 more, all of them standing shoulder to shoulder in front of the assembled prisoners. The count still ongoing, Pino stood on his tiptoes, remembering some of the conversation General Lyers had had with Cardinal Schuster. To his horror, he heard Tullio say,
10,
becoming the 15th man.
"You 15 in the lorry," a black shirt said. "The rest of you return to your cells."
Pino didn't know what to do, torn between wanting to go to General Lyers and to Tullio. But if he went to Lyers and admitted Tullio was his close friend, and Tullio was in San Vittore for spying for the resistance, wouldn't he begin to suspect?
"What are you doing in here, Vorarbeiter?"
Lyers demanded. Pino had been so mesmerized by the unfolding scene that he'd lost track of Lyers, who now stood beside him, glaring.
"I'm sorry, mon général," Pino said. "I thought you might need a translator." "Go to the car, now," Lyers said. "Bring it up after this lorry exits."
Pino saluted, then ran out of the prison gates to the Daimler and climbed in. The lorry parked outside San Vittore began to roll. Pino started the staff car just as the first sun hit the prison's upper walls and around the arch of the gate. In the shadows below, the lorry bearing Tullio and the other 14 emerged and followed. Pino drove up to the gate. The general didn't bother waiting for him to open the door. He climbed into the back, his face twisted in barely controlled fury.
"Mon général?" Pino asked after they'd sat there a moment.
"The hell with it," Lyers said. "Follow them, Vorarbeiter."
5. The Daimler quickly caught up to the lorries as they lumbered through the city. Pino wanted to ask the general what was happening. He wanted to tell him about Tullio, but didn't dare. As he drove around the piazza in front of the Duomo, he glanced up at the highest spire on the cathedral, saw it embraced by the sun, while the gargoyles on the lower flanks of the church remained in the deepest of dark shadows. The sight troubled him deeply.
Mon général, Pino said. I know you said not to speak, but can you tell me what is going to happen to the men in that lorry?
Liars didn't answer.